Well, Chris Benoit making his debut in pro wrestling. I'm not saying this because you're standing in front of me. I thought you did a terrific job. How do you feel?
Thank you very much, Miss Whelan.
I came here in a time machine that you invented. Now, I need your help to get back to the year 1985.
From Television City in Hollywood.
This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com. The only place to be in your pop culture world.
Discretionary viewer participation is advised for the following professional wrestling exhibition.
Greetings from Allentown is taped in front of a live studio audience.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 134 of Greetings from Allentown. I'm your host, Peter Winston, and today, going to a brand new territory, just as I went to Kansas City 2 weeks ago, but this time going north of the border up to Stampede Wrestling out of Calgary, and this would be the second or third version of it, depending on your accounting methodology. I'm going to get into it in a little while, for November 22nd, 1985. There are a lot of familiar names and faces in Stampede at this point, and hopefully I'm able to kind of put it all together in a nice little package, considering that going into the show, there's no real introduction as to who the two guys doing play-by-play and color are, but as I learned, the play-by-play guy, of course, is Ed Whelan, longtime producer of Stampede Wrestling television dating back to the original version, and the other guy is named Jim Davies, which I learned later on, but that's a whole other thing. But let me get in my plugs first. You can email the show, greensmountaintown@gmail.com. Facebook.com/GreetingsFromAllentown. Give me a follow on Twitter at GF Allentown Pod. That is at GF Allentown Pod. I'm posting a lot of stuff on Twitter. I posted a poll for next week's show that the voting will be closed by the time this show drops, but it was between an episode of Superstars from 1988, shortly after the Survivor Series, in fact, the Saturday after that, or the July 11th, 1994 Raw, which people remember mostly, or pretty much only, for the Bret Hart versus the 1-2-3 Kid matchup. That one of the best matches on Raw, at least during that early era. And you may be listening to the show on the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Pro Wrestling Only, you can listen to other shows that drops in, like WorldCast. Look at World Class Championship Wrestling now in September of 1983. The Days of Thunder podcast dropped last Thursday. You get close to Spring Stampede 1998, so that would be April of 98. Bigfoot Pro Wrestling podcast dropped last Monday or Tuesday, I forget which, but looking at independent pro wrestling in the Pacific Northwest. As for me, as for my week leading up to this, I mean, I am just nerve-wracked to hell, and I don't want to turn this into like a Woody Allen type, you know, like one of those characters where I'm all sort of, you know, bent out of shape and just neurotic as hell. But when you're not working and you're applying for jobs and you actually are getting interviews and you're going on interviews, two or three of them in a given week for 3 or 4 weeks in a row, and you don't hear anything back, it's extremely nerve-wracking. I don't particularly care for many human resource departments because they will ghost you at the first opportunity. And if somebody's actually listening to this podcast, well, thank you for listening. If you did interview me at some point in the past and you want to find out a little bit more about me, but you know, I always felt the need to actually communicate with people. I don't know. I mean, maybe that's just me. Instead of just leaving me at home, chewing my nails, stress eating, I'm trying to cut back on drinking because I don't think that it's particularly healthy. And also, I've had to start taking these Alka-Seltzer things that remind me of Mentos, which is why I probably took them in the first place. Except I'm not turning to the camera at the end and smiling and giving thumbs up. I just feel a weird tightness in my chest. It's probably gas, which means I got a fart. And you know, if you can't fart, you can't live. It's just a really stressful time right now because I've never really been in this situation. Yeah, I've looked for jobs, and obviously I got hired at a place last year, but that was through a recruiting firm, so it's like, oh, they're delivering the news to me. It's not like I'm being directly hired by the company. That hasn't happened for me in 11 years. So it'd go back to the beginning of my previous job, so I don't know what to think at this point. I'm just kind of sitting here waiting for the phone to ring, and who knows when that might happen. I guess the wheels turn slowly, but my mother's birthday was over the weekend, so to kind of distract myself from that, I took her to breakfast on Friday, which was nice, but I also had her over for dinner because she loves stuff off the grill. So I made some steak. She came over to the house on Monday night. But a very interesting thing occurred, and this is Seinfeld related, apparently. On Saturday afternoon, my wife was out shopping and ran into my sister and her daughter in, I don't know if it was in the store or in the parking lot or whatever. And just like on Seinfeld, when Jerry kind of accidentally brought up Kramer's party to Crazy Joe Davola, my sister says, "Oh, so I guess we'll be seeing you and Peter tonight." And my wife was like, I don't know what you're talking about. We weren't invited. Yes, apparently my other sister threw something for my mother and did not invite me, which I don't have any idea why that happened, but I have to assume it's because they got shamed into having something for my mother because I took her out to breakfast and was having her over for dinner on Monday night and they were doing nothing. So I don't know. I'm just trying to live my life according to, you know, the dictum, or that's kind of an appropriate thing. Don't be a dick, okay, in your everyday life. I'm not going to go on a whole speech here like Mr. T talking about my mother. However, I will become as mad as the big boss man if you were to make jokes about my mother going forward. But that's, I guess that's for another time. So why don't we just go right into Stampede Wrestling. This version from 1985 was about a month old. And everybody knows, who's even cursorily familiar with pro wrestling, that Stampede, the Calgary area, has produced a lot of talent over the years. You got the whole, well, at least most of the Hart family. Let's start with Brett and Owen, and we'll leave it there. In that next generation, you have Lance Storm and Chris Jericho, and also a guy by the name of Chris Benoit, who makes his pro wrestling debut on this show, which is a little weird, I have to say, you know, doing a show kind of based around that as one of the big sort of hooks, but he is one of the guys who came out of here and was a very high-profile wrestler for a number of years. But also, the stars that came out of this area, the future Junkyard Dog, Sylvester Ritter, had his early years up in Stampede. Bad News Allen, another guy we actually see on this show, was in Stampede for a very long time. Both of the British Bulldogs, Davey Boy Smith and Dynamite Kid. I guess Davey Boy could maybe be considered part of the Hart family, although he actually, you know, sort of married into it, just like Jim the Anvil Neidhart did, another guy who came out of Stampede. So it produced a lot of talent over the years coming out of there. And this territory was primarily known for having long travels on icy cold roads, you know, all across Western Canada and down, I believe part of the territory kind of slid down into the United States, into Montana and whatnot, that whole area out there. So 1984 rolls around, seminal year in professional wrestling. The WWF, quote-unquote, and the quotes are very important here, buys the territory, but not because, oh, they wanted to run a developmental out there or because they really, really wanted to get the TV slot or anything, which you'd see in other areas. They just wanted to get the talent that was available there. So Bret Hart, Davey Boy Smith, Dynamite Kid, they wanted to get at those guys and not necessarily really anybody else. I mean, maybe access to the towns as well, although they would certainly have, I think, decidedly mixed results at best when it came to going into the towns. Late 1984, they're running shows in Vancouver and Calgary, and the attendance numbers are probably not what they wanted at that point, and they were trying to use the local talent. But they're just trying to keep the guys that they wanted from Stampede Wrestling in the fold. So Flash forward, early 1985, a sort of fake stampede emerges early in the year, around February and March. It does not last very long. There's no involvement from the Hart family, Stu, or any of the rest. Now, why were they able to actually use the term stampede wrestling? Apparently, what happened, and I learned this from listening to Between the Sheets earlier this year when they were covering February or March of 1985, Stu Hart never trademarked the name Stampede Wrestling, which seems like a real mistake since that was his promotion. But it's not surprising that a guy who would use the same spatula to clean up cat shit and flip eggs would also kind of forget to trademark the name of the territory. But hey, it didn't last very long. 3 weeks, the Harts made it clear that they were not a part of this, and it went under fairly quickly and apparently stranded some wrestlers, and there was a whole controversy with that. So go forward about 6 months to late October of 1985. There are a couple of stories that I've heard on how this relaunch sort of happened. One is that Bruce Hart, the kind of ne'er-do-well brother of the Hart family, who some people don't really seem to like all that much. I may or may not be one of them. I'm going to give him a clean slate going through this show. He's sort of lone wolfish, and he relaunched the territory in late October of 85, just kind of without really getting much of a blessing from anybody. The other story that I've seen is that the WWF went to the Hart family and said, look, we cannot live up to the agreement that we made with you last year, in 1984, to, you know, buy the territory from Stu. Now, this is shocking on a couple of different levels. First of all, Vince McMahon going to the Hart family and saying, we can't live up to an agreement that was 1 year into it. What is this? Some sort of tradition that he would do every single decade where, like, yes, I'm going to have a contractual agreement with somebody in the Hart family, but a year from now, well, you know, I'm going to back out of it. Maybe Brett should have thought of that in 96 when he signed that deal, because, well, Vince is just going to come to him in a year and say, well, you know, I'm just going to renege on the whole thing. The story is also that Vince wasn't paying for the territory in part because, well, my payment is giving employment to Brett and Davey Boy. I have no idea. The whole thing is kind of foggy to me. But the fact is this gets relaunched and we have this television to go on. And this version runs to 1989, and you see stars emerge from here, namely because you got Brett in the WWF already at this point. So this version kind of launches the career of Owen Hart, who debuts the following year. You got Benoit, as I mentioned. And then also Brian Pillman comes along in 87 and 88 and kind of gets his start here as well. I didn't mention him as one of the people, but this is where he kind of goes before he emerges in NWA, WCW in 1989. 89, of course, a year where a lot of territories were ending, and that's when this ended as well. You got World Class, Continental, and probably others that I'm not even thinking of that go under in that year, but those are certainly the highest profile ones. But as I said, very familiar names, but maybe not familiar faces, such as the Cuban Assassin. I'll get into more on that later, because there's more than one Cuban Assassin in wrestling history. Mike Shaw, certainly a familiar face, but not necessarily by that name, either in the WWF under his various gimmicks, or even in Stampede, where he was known as other things. Bad News Brown, who is known as Bad News Allen at this point, Allen Coage or Coge. I've never really gotten the exact 411 on how that's pronounced, but he's being referred to as Good News here for some reason, because he's a babyface, and I'm so excited for this because I love me some Bad News Brown, and to see him being cheered, that's very interesting. And this is also earlier in his career. I'm going to look up and see if I can find any weekly TV from his brief 1979 WWF run. Excuse me. And Honky Tonk Wayne Ferris is here. He's one half of the tag team champions alongside Ron Starr. And this is another guy who got, you know, kind of became a big deal in Stampede and eventually emerges in the WWF years later. As I mentioned, he's one half of the tag team champions. The other champions in this promotion at this time, the North American champion, technically is Kerry Brown, who had won it November 21st, 85. So this show's November 22nd. So he won it 21st in Edmonton. The British Commonwealth champion, Stampede British Commonwealth mid-heavyweight champion is Bruce Hart, who is under some sort of suspension, which never quite got explained to me all that much. But I'm not going to investigate too much because it's a Bruce Hart thing, and it just sort of is what it is. So without any further ado, why don't we just jump right into the show with Stampede Wrestling, November 22nd, 1985. But here's my number, so call me maybe. And all the other boys try to chase me. But here's my number, so call me maybe. That is not tying back to my whole job thing and waiting for the phone to ring. It's actually that the artist behind that song and great earworm, Call Me Maybe, Carly Rae Jepsen, was born the day before this show aired, November 21st, 1985, and also was born in Western Canada. So she came out of the womb just in time to see our first match, which is Chris Benoit teaming up with Rick Patterson to take on Carl Moffat and Mike Hammer. Now, Patterson, you know, you know a little bit more about his tag team partner. He's probably best known for being the second Leatherface in Japan. Kind of a cool gimmick that was originally played by who you would know as Corporal Kirshner in the WWF in the mid-80s. Well, he got into some legal troubles, and Patterson ended up assuming the role for a while. Patterson was never in the WWE or F or WCW or ECW, but on his record, there's a lot of Mexico and Japan, and he is Canadian because using mostly Canadian citizens on Stampede Wrestling. I don't know if it's directly connected to the CanCon regulations, which, you know, provides that Canadian content has to be above a certain percentage. As for Benoit making his debut here, Wrestling Observer Newsletter Hall of Famer Chris Benoit. Think of all the people after, you know, the murder-suicide back in 2007. Think of all the people who have that name. In trying to, you know, look up a list of people with the last name, you end up with a lot of French names like Benoit Hogue, Benoit Pouliot. I don't know why I'm only saying hockey player names. It's the ones that I know the best. People who had that first name. But for the last name, like the girl that I knew in college whose name was Christy Benoit, who watched wrestling with our group regularly when she was going to Boston University. You know, kind of feel bad for her years later when this goes down. Although, just like Joan Benoit, the long-distance runner, winner, multiple-time winner of the Boston Marathon, 1984 Olympic gold medalist in the women's marathon, the first women's marathon that they had in the Olympics, they can get married and remove the Benoit or Benoit from their name. Now, if you're a guy like Benoit's son there, who's kind of on the indies, David Benoit, I think might want to change the name a little bit. Now, I know that it's, you know, to kind of call attention to yourself to have that last name, and it's, it does feel awkward to tell somebody, hey, change your family name. But when a homicide happens, the rules kind of change. I'm thinking of other stuff, too. I mean, different spellings, just from how you pronounce things, like Benoit balls. Like, what's happened to them in the last 11 years? I mean, are people shoving them up their rectums the way they were before the Benoit murders? Because when you say Benoit, you know, you now think of something else. Again, spelled differently. But as for Chris Benoit, I mean, I swear, there are people who just claim conspiracy on that thing, and the only reason they're doing it is not because they have this, oh, I was friends with the guy and I want to believe the best about him. I think part of it might be that, but a lot of it is, if I say something nutty about the Chris Benoit thing, oh, well, it's going to be reported on every wrestling news site, which means, look at me, I'm Hornswoggle, and I say something stupid about Chris Benoit murdering his wife and child and then hanging himself. If I say something about that, then my name will be out there on all the wrestling sites for a little while after. I mean, I'm not impinging on, say, Hornswoggle's character. I'm just saying it's a stupid freaking thing to do to kind of get your name out there. So I just want to nip that crap in the butt. And as we start There's no intro to the show. Like, as the video starts, you get the opening theme, which is pretty cool. It's almost like a marching band. And Moffat has Benoit in a chin lock as we get underway. And Moffat, also known as Jason the Terrible, is one of his other gimmicks. Moffat, you say that last name, it makes me think of the Boston Bruins goalie from the 1982 playoffs, who everybody kind of gave credit for, but he apparently famously would throw up before every game, which might have been par for the course for goaltenders, but he was so reliable that the Bruins went out and traded for Pete Peters in that offseason. Certainly one of my favorite names of any goaltender era ever. And I feel free to talk about this because this is a Stampede show and any hockey talk should be out there. Pete Peters, not to digress too much, but this story is so great, became available in trade from the Philadelphia Flyers, not because they had a young Pelle Lindbergh coming up through their system, but he had an incident with a reporter where somebody called him Red Light Peters or something like that because of the goal light behind him being red. And apparently this reporter got pinned down by Peters and presumably somebody else and had literally had a light bulb shoved into his rectum. And that's two rectum shoving up things that I've had so far. So maybe I should just get back to the wrestling. And Moffat's career actually was derailed in a 1989, July of 89, car accident in which Benoit and Davey Boy Smith were in the car. Ross Hart was driving, and he suffered some serious injuries, and it really kind of, it didn't knock him out his career, or end his career right away, but it derailed it considerably, and he later went on to become a truck driver. And Benoit battles out of that chin lock, and his hair is not the short that, you know, short hair that you would see later on. In fact, it looks an awful lot like very early Family Ties, Alex P. Keaton, so kind of your Michael J. Fox. And hey, you know, when you're in Western Canada, it's late 1985, you should make your hair look like Michael J. Fox. He was the hot thing at the time. Trade of clotheslines, and then Moffat is then slammed off the top rope, and a reversal of a corner whip by Benoit, and Moffat takes the Bret Hart bump face first into the turnbuckle. So apparently, the Hitman not alone in that one. A tag to Patterson, who works over Moffat for a bit with a flying head scissors, but then Hammer is able to tag into that match. He gets the tag from Moffat, and no knee pads on Mike Hammer, by the way, who puts his head down as we get a leapfrog by Patterson and a backbreaker for two, which is actually broken up. That does not kick out. Boston Crab now by Patterson on Hammer, and Moffat comes into the ring again to break it up. And I'm scratching my head, why has this team not been given a yellow card yet? Now, you're probably saying, why the hell are you conflating soccer with Stampede Wrestling? Well, this particular version of Stampede, I don't recall from any of the earlier Stampede. I did watch some of it when it was briefly on the WWE Network around late 2015. They put up a couple of Stampedes from 79, but before Bret Hart had it taken down because it was all Bret matches and he didn't want them on there for whatever reason. Did not know if they had a yellow card, red card system going on, but here in this match, I'm wondering why this referee is sort of letting it go. Benoit gets the tag. All four men are into the ring. So you get the corner. They're all in the corner. And you're wondering, well, how's it going to go? Which two guys are going to crash into each other in the middle? And it ends up with Hammer and Benoit about to run into each other. Hammer puts his head down. And Benoit, thinking fast because he's not yet brain damaged, gets the sunset flip for the 1-2-3. So the team of Chris Benoit and Rick Patterson prevail in this one, and Benoit wins his professional wrestling debut, at least according to the records. I mean, who knows? Maybe he worked an outlaw mud show somewhere. I mean, I don't know, but this seems to be agreed upon as his debut. So kind of an interesting little match, although you kind of get that taste of the odd production that Stampede would do, as we just cut right to the match as the show starts. A couple of minutes in, they do let you know how much you missed, but their tendency to clip all of these matches can be a little frustrating, especially for something that is the debut of a guy who would go on to win many titles in professional wrestling before, you know, the other thing. But I'm going to put that aside for now, because this is very interesting in its own right, not just because it's his debut, but Chris Benoit is 18 years old at this point, 18 and a half, if you want to be even more precise. And just thinking of where I was in my life, it's like I'm first semester freshman year at Boston University, one of the more awkward times of my life. And here you got Benoit at that young age, never a particularly great promo himself, always a little bit awkward in his own right. And what we have now is a sort of battle for Benoit, although it's really not much of a battle. It is just one heel manager who's going to interrupt, you know, his first promo to the audience and kind of woo him a little bit and maybe to get him to join up for his army.
It felt great to have my first match win. And
what is this? What is this?
Hey, kid, I like your style. I like the way you wrestle. I think you're going to make a big name for yourself. How would you like to join JR's army?
I don't have nothing to do with that.
What is this?
Oh.
Foley, you jerk. What are you doing up here?
Shut up, Mr. Whalen!
I know I also said this about Lance Russell in one of the Memphis shows, but Ed Whalen, in showing his disdain, what are you doing, you big jerk? Kind of using the same tone of voice that I use when the cat scratches the couch. It's one of those things, but Benoit gets jumped right away, which, by the way, all he says once is, I don't really want to be any part of it. And they just jump him immediately. It's not like you're going to ask him again and make him say no two or three times. He says no once, and they go at him. It's J.R. Foley is the heel manager here in Stampede Wrestling, and it's Carl Moffat who goes in and just kind of beats him down, lays him out with a pile driver before. You're never going to guess who comes out and makes the save. It's Bruce Hart, who, as I said, is suspended under some sort of mysterious thing that they didn't really go too much into detail on, but that's okay. But a rather interesting and eventful debut for one Mr. Chris Benoit. A little bumper there kind of reminds me of the Memphis bumper that I love so much with the do 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 do. And it kind of Stampede reminds me of Memphis in some ways. Now, one Twitter account, one of my favorite Twitter accounts that I follow, at Crispy Lettuce. You probably know that if you listen to this show. You know that Twitter account. He had a tweet a couple, I think less than a week ago, actually bringing it up. It's from September 9th. It says, Canadian territory wrestling is so different from Southern territory wrestling. Now, that could mean, you know, Maritimes or anything else, but when you think of Canadian territory wrestling, to me, Stampede comes before anything else. And I was thinking about it compared with Memphis as an example. And it could, Southern territory wrestling could mean Southeastern / Continental. It could mean championship wrestling from Florida. It could mean a lot of different things. But Stampede and Memphis have some similarities just that came to mind even before I read that tweet. Like Stu Hart and Jerry Jarrett, I kind of make them as sort of equal, sort of like the name that's above all else as, you know, the promoter or whatever of the territory. Ed Whalen and Lance Russell on the announcer side. Obviously, Lance Russell is the gold standard and can't be matched by Ed Whalen. And Ed kind of has the same folksy manner as Lance, as you're going to hear on some of the clips coming up. But Ed Whalen is a little bit more annoying because of how it came out that he would edit out angles on the weekly TV if he didn't approve of it, and just kind of had a little too much dictatorial power over the production. And Honky Tonk Man, or Honky Tonk Wayne, as he's known here in Stampede, maybe less than Jerry Lawler down in Tennessee. Now, it might be kind of an unfair matchup. Maybe I should put Bret Hart in that spot, but I don't know. I was just comparing Memphis and Stampede. It's sort of like a copy of a copy up in Stampede. You get a little bit less out of it, but I'm still enjoying it quite fine as we go into our next match, which is the Cobra George Takano taking on the Cuban Assassin. Now, this is the Cobra's debut, or at least it's listed as such, in this version of Stampede. It's actually his last stop before he returns to Japan for good. This Cuban Assassin, I had mentioned there's some familiar names and faces back in the intro. This is a familiar name, the Cuban Assassin. However, this is not Fidel Sierra, Dave Sierra, whoever, who you'd see in the NWA in 1989. This is a completely different Cuban Assassin. And once again, it's Joined in Progress for some reason, 5 minutes into the match, because I don't, you know, maybe upon watching this whole thing through, there's a legitimate reason for that. You can also fit in more matches if you edit it down and you can run longer matches for the live crowd. So I could maybe see the argument from that perspective. You're not having pure enhancement matches or whatever, but it's just kind of an odd thing where it's not complete matches for this territory. As I'm watching this bout between the Cobra and the Cuban Assassin, while they're working a headlock spot, I thought to myself, if we flash forward to WCW in, let's say, 1995, 96, did the Cobra from that period, Jeff Farmer, who would go on to become NWO Sting, did he ever face the other Cuban Assassin in WCW? And the answer is no. Apparently, that did not take place, or I found at least no record of it. What's interesting here in Stampede, and I saw a little bit of this on WWF shows in 83 and 84, where they would read a letter from the fans that had been sent in. And apparently here, 1985 Stampede and the reboot, they did something similar, the letter of the week.
By the way, Ed, I've got the letter of the week to Stampede Wrestling. It says, "Dear friend Bruce, I've been a fan of yours for quite a few years. Want you to know that your fans support you 100%. Too bad you were suspended, but I know if you get a rematch with the Great Gamma, you'll beat him fairly. Good luck from your fan, Claude Follis." And it says, "P.S., I think you and Dan Crawford should team up and beat the so-called champs, the cowardly, cheating, poor sports, honky-tonk man and Rotten Ron star for the International Tag Team belts."
So there's the reference to Bruce Hart's suspension, which I actually watched the TV for a couple of weeks before this and the week after this, and I couldn't quite figure out what it was. Maybe I fell asleep and missed it. I don't know. But for certain, we know that Bruce Hart's alias is Claude Paulus writing a letter. Can you imagine, like, taking pen to paper, which is what you would have done in 1985? Like, you love Bruce Hart that much that you're going to write to the wrestling show and say, "Not only do I think you're going to beat the Great Gamma, but I think you should team up with Dan Crawford and take down the tag team champions as well." Come on! I am calling shenanigans on that from start to finish. I mean, this thing is rather dull. Cuban Assassin and cheats to gain an advantage and then does the King of the Mountain spot. So we're not seeing cool stuff from the Cobra. This is not Cobra versus Tiger Mask here. And they mentioned that Cobra is out of Uganda, which I don't remember anything about him being billed from there, but this is where commentary takes a bizarre turn.
A few years ago, I haven't heard in the last two or three years, but a few years back, this program was the number one show in Uganda, Stampede Wrestling.
Back then, the only two names they knew in Uganda were Idi Amin and Ed Whalen.
Boy, don't team me with that.
Now, that whole thing about Uganda sounds like something out of the bullshit game that I liked to play several years ago, which was basically you'd say something about a celebrity that's plausible enough that, yeah, the person's probably going to believe it, and it's maybe a little bit hard to sort of research. Like, the one that I came up with that sounds most plausible is the person who's singing backup on the song Holiday Road by Lindsey Buckingham is actually Beverly D'Angelo because it was on National Lampoon's Vacation. It sounds like it's correct because it sounds like a woman's voice in the background. She's in the movie. She is actually an accomplished singer. But it's actually not true. It's Lindsey Buckingham providing backup vocals on his own track. So that's what I'm getting at. Saying Ed Whalen is so popular in Uganda and that Stampede Wrestling is huge there sounds like it's from the bullshit game, but it is actually true. And let me pull this clip or this passage from Pain and Passion, the History of Stampede Wrestling, which I think came out in the year 2010. It's by Heath McCoy. It's just this one little thing sort of blew my mind. In a March 1981 wrestling program, Stu writes that Stampede Wrestling had been voted the most popular TV sports show in Saudi Arabia. Well, geez, they maybe should have had the idea to run supercards over there. It also had a devoted following in West Germany, Singapore, Bangkok, Nigeria, Tanzania, and Uganda. Ed Whalen, his wife Naomi says, received a letter in the 1970s from Idi Amin, the Ugandan dictator. Amin was such a Stampede Wrestling fan that he wanted to bring the show to his country, and he invited the announcer to be a guest in his home. While Ed and Naomi were avid travelers, they politely declined the invitation, Naomi says. So I guess Ed Whalen has higher standards than Vince McMahon is what I can take out of that. He will not have this promotion go over and perform for the benefit of dictators. Although, to be fair, Idi Amin's only watching like the regular shows. He doesn't have the benefit of the Stampede Wrestling Network that he could just pull up some show from 1971 on the stream. I mean, you know, so we have kind of an advantage these days. But at first I was like, what the hell? And then finding out that that was true is kind of funny. Spin kick by the Cobra, who then runs into a foot, and a Cuban Assassin elbow gets a two count. A corner whip, but the Cobra bounces out of there quickly with a clothesline and hits a stomp off the top rope, very much shades of Finn Balor these days, and a drop kick off an Irish whip gets a two count as the Assassin got his foot on the ropes. And now we get the hide the foreign object spot as the Cuban Assassin sort of recovers from things. Again, that's also a very Memphis-y sort of thing where, you know, he's just going to keep moving around the foreign object. Yes, you'd see it in other places, but if you're going to define that by one territory, it would probably be Memphis. But the Cuban Assassin now gets a yellow card from the referee. So that's one warning. Two yellow cards, that's your second warning. And then your third warning is a red card in which you are disqualified. He's doing the King of the Mountain spot here as Cobra eventually fights his way and gains a bit of control as Ed talks about how it was a bitterly cold Friday in Calgary. Jeez, in late November, you don't say. I was really surprised. No Calgary Flames game on that night. They were on their way to the finals and the Stanley Cup finals that year. They lost to Montreal, and in fact the next night on Hockey Night in Canada they lost 4-3 to the Canadiens in a Stanley Cup finals preview. And the CFL season was over at that point, and Calgary's team, the Stampeders, went 3-13. Anyway, back to the match. Cobra puts his head down, a cardinal mistake for a ring veteran from the land of Uganda, where he could have been watching Stampede Wrestling, apparently, in 1981, if he was actually from there and not actually from Japan. But he fires back with two drop kicks as the Cuban Assassin has this one guy who's very vocal in the crowd. I don't know if it's like the local communist of Alberta or what's going on, but Cobra goes up top and he flips off the top rope up and over the Cuban Assassin as he comes at him, and then goes up onto the second rope and kind of does that Jacques Rougeau move where he comes back with the cross body block, and that scores the 1-2-3, the Cobra victorious here over the Cuban Assassin. A very, very tight edit to this match. There's no announcement saying, here's your winner, the Cobra. Once again, Ed Whalen just makes some bizarre decisions. He's kind of like a guy where you got a roll of toothpaste, right? And you're going to have a hard time getting all of it out of there. But you're gonna have to squeeze it really, really hard at the end. And maybe it won't even fill your toothbrush. He won't even throw that away. He will put there'll be 1% of the sour cream left. But he's going to put it back in the fridge. Apparently, that's Ed Whalen's way. As we go to a local promo for, well, I guess somewhat local, for a show coming up on December 11th at the PNE Gardens in Vancouver, which is now the Garden Auditorium. It's actually the National Exhibition Grounds has different venues there, and I was hoping it would be the venue that's now known as the PNE Agrodome, because that has the distinction of having hosted in 1985 the Ivan Drago Rocky Balboa fight as filmed for Rocky IV. So I don't know how it would go. If Bruce Hart can win the title, then maybe we all could change, because it would have to involve him somehow just based on what's gone on here. But now, actually, Bruce Hart is here in the interview area, and he's with Bad News Allen. Or is it Good News Allen? Who knows? But I am so excited to see this guy before the WWF run from 88 through 90 that I so know and love. The interesting thing about this promo is that Bad News is a babyface, which I guess is where the Good News thing comes in. As a fan of WWF, I always thought if Bad News Brown turned good, as I put it back in the day, that he would become Good News Brown. Not sure how that would have played out, but as I've always said, if he comes around in 1998-99, he is a super over babyface just based on the attitude and the character that he displayed. So to hear him be a, well, to use the terminology of the time, a fan favorite is also particularly enlightening, especially since we're so used to that character. Like, let me tell you, Beer Belly Sharecropper's one thing.
Yes, I'd just like to say one thing first, that my good friend Bruce Allen, who's promoting this match out here, he sent for me. I haven't been in this area in a long time, and he wants me to clean up the garbage, and I'm going to start with the Cabbage Patch Kid, Carrie Brown. I mean, this man has double-crossed me. He's done everything under the sun to try to hurt me, but I guarantee you, Mr. Brown, that when you're in there with the ring with me, you know I can wrestle by the rules, or I can break the rules just as well as you can. I also, let me say one thing, that my good friend over here, Bruce Hart, he's in there with that Gamma Singh, and this is going to be a street fight. As you people know, I'm from Harlem. And that's the number one place of street fighting. When you come out of there, you know it all. And I'm teaching this man here all the dirty tricks that he knows and a little bit that I know. And this will teach Mr. Gamma a little lesson.
Felt like there was some sort of missing oomph to the character, which I'm not going to lay so much on Bad News, but more on the fact that Bruce Hart is just standing there with his arms crossed the entire time. It's like, what are you doing there? Like, why can't you talk about your match with Gamma Singh? Apparently, is this Bruce Hart's not allowed to talk because he's suspended? Actually, it might not be a bad thing. So, yet one more interview here, and it's three men, Kerry Brown, Ron Starr, and the Honky Tonk Man. The latter two are the tag team champions, as I mentioned. And yes, Honky Tonk Wayne, as he was known at the time, still very much the same character, but a lot of the cartoonish elements don't really appear until he gets to the WWF about a year after this.
Don't forget, Ellie Mae, look at this fine fur coat. We purchased this after we defeated Dynamite Kid and David Boy Smith right there in Vancouver. We went and took that money we made for that match. We bought this woman a fur coat. I'm going to put her in some diamond rings. We're going to have her riding in limousines. You know what I'm talking about. We're going to have this woman doing everything we want.
Hey, you don't know, Vancouver. We might even bring Miss Ellie out there with us next time. Now let's get down to some business. Vancouver, PNE Garden, 7:30, December the 11th.
Oh no, that was not an editing mistake on my part. I just wanted to leave that all in as it aired to illustrate how Ron Starr got cut off mid-sentence. Like, yep, okay, December 11th at the PNE Gardens. Great. And then nothing. They go right into the bumper to the next thing. I mean, Ed Whelan, he might be the kind of guy when he goes to the drive-thru, when he has to roll his window down to, you know, place his order, where he actually turns off the air conditioning because he rolled down to one window, which I want to say is strange, except for the fact that I also do that as well. I don't know if that's a widespread thing, but I know it kind of drives... I don't know if that drives my wife... No, the thing that drives my wife insane is, for some reason, when I approach a toll booth, even though it's easy pass and you don't have to roll down a window, I turn down the radio. I have some sort of weird instinct to do that. Why do I do that? Am I alone in that?
Good morning, everyone. The moment is at hand. President Reagan now is at a lakeside mansion about 8 miles north of Geneva. Flordeau, it is called, the Flower Water House. And it is there that the president will meet this morning with Mikhail Gorbachev of the Soviet Union. The first meeting between the leaders of the two most powerful forces in the history of civilization in more than 6 years now, and it will be a dramatic opening session.
It's always been interesting to me in my study of international affairs, mostly dating back to college, but in books that I've read since, the sort of personal rapport that Ronald Reagan had with Mikhail Gorbachev. You think it wouldn't have happened based on the saber-rattling of Reagan in his first term when he didn't meet with any Soviet leaders because he said that they kept dying on him, which was actually true, but the two guys had a lot in common, but to hear Tom Brokaw put it, the two most powerful forces in the universe. I thought Brokaw was going to break out and do the Vince McMahon intro for WrestleMania 6. Like, two galaxies collide. Like, all right, does this mean that Reagan or Gorbachev is going to sell a knee injury early in the summit, and then eventually they're going to have an uncomfortable test of strength spot where it looks like one is performing oral on the other? Yeah, I'm just thinking of the whole Ultimate Warrior Hogan match from WrestleMania 6 as performed by Mikhail Gorbachev and Ronald Reagan, which I'm sure somebody who's particularly nerdy in international affairs has already recreated in something like WrestleMania 2000 in the past. In fact, my friend Merrill might have done that, because I don't know. I think he created Reagan for that game, but I think he created Reagan to be a jobber because he's such a liberal. So anyway, up next we have Dan Crawford, Cowboy Dan Crawford, as he was known, taking on Mike Shaw. Now, Crawford, he's winding down his career, I should say, but he's probably best known as being the innovator of the ladder match. And yes, that was something that was done in Stampede dating all the way back to the mid-70s, I believe, and various guys had that match long before the WWF adopted it, and Bret Hart supposedly brought that idea along to them. Now, Dan Crawford, as I said, he's winding down his career. This is no relation to the guy who was known as Phil LaFon in the WWF, who went by the name Dan Crawford as one half of the Can-Am Express, primarily in Japan, and that was just kind of a tribute to Dan Crawford, the earlier one. So anyway, Mike Shaw, also a man of many names, Norman, Norman the Lunatic, Norman the Trucker, Bastard Booger, Friar Ferguson, and Makin Singh, which was a gimmick that he was, it seems like he was starting to adopt it here in this version of Stampede. He's not quite there yet, but the next week he shows up on television and he's wearing sort of the garb alongside Gama Singh. So I don't know if it went any further than that, because when I was watching it, that was as far as the Stampede had been posted on YouTube by the uploader. It's such a shame that, you know, that happened to him during his career. As it said in the Observer, they don't know who he pissed off in a previous life to get some of these gimmicks, but he's not the first guy in wrestling history to be done in by silly crap like that, and he's probably not going to be the last. But thinking about Mike Shaw, the man, the wrestler, and yeah, he looked a little slobbish, which is how you end up with a Bastion Booger thing in the first place, especially crossed with somebody like Vince McMahon, who has weird, you know, fetishes and stuff. Drop Mike Shaw from, let's say, a couple years after this. Give him a little bit more seasoning, 86 and 87, the heart of his Makin Singh era, and into 88 as well. Drop him into the indies scene now in pro wrestling, which, granted, is probably going to start to see a bit of a slump as everybody got gobbled up by AEW, MLW, you know, where, what have you. You drop a guy like that in the indies, he's going to be incredibly in demand. Like, he would be a big star now just on that scene alone. A hot-ass commodity, which I don't think has ever been said about Mike Shaw, but dudes that size, big guys, they never go out of style in pro wrestling. Yeah, you can have a trim 180-pound guy who could dive around the ring, who could do planches and do all sorts of high-flying stuff, and yeah, that'll bring fans in. However, you put that guy against a 330-pound brick wall, like I said, that never goes out of style all throughout wrestling history. It's kind of like I always talk about in football, a pocket passer never goes out of style. I mean, it's something that's just been constant all through the history of the NFL. You see these read option guys like your Robert Griffin III. He had his little run. Kaepernick had his run, which ended for maybe different reasons. But all I'm saying is there's a certain type of guy, probably in any profession that you see, that's just there is a constant. And Mike Shaw, I think, would have fit into that. Now, Crawford, He has a bounty on his head by that manager, J.R. Foley, who we saw earlier, his man attacking Benoit for not joining up. He's very popular in 1985 to be putting bounties on people's head. But then again, that's something that stretches all the way through the 80s. You could find at any given territory, somebody had a bounty on somebody's head at every point in the 80s up to that point. You had Ric Flair, a bounty on his head in 83, but Flair putting a bounty on the Von Erichs in 82. I mean, honestly, it just never ends. I'd said 330. Shaw is actually an even 320 for this match. He definitely looks lighter, for sure, compared to what you'd see later on in WCW, and especially when he gets the WWF. He tosses Crawford to the outside, and then when Crawford gets back in, he just throws him out on the opposite side. So it's like, okay. So he's not even going to do the King of the Mountain spot where he keeps him from getting in the ring. He's going to get him back in and just throw him out. And Crawford, apparently the whole feud with the bounty started out with, he took the money and didn't follow through on what Foley wanted him to do. So it's kind of a simple thing to get back to him. I mean, I don't know why that makes him the babyface, but hey. I mean, he got one over on the heel manager, which is probably enough. Now, Crawford, when he gets back in again, he is tossed out to a third side of the ring. So now we'll see if Shaw can throw him out that fourth side to complete it. It's kind of like a strap match. You drag the guy around to all four corners. Instead, in this match, you have to throw him out of the ring on all four sides. And Shaw would be victorious, almost, in that case. However, Crawford gets back in the ring, and he is pretty pissed off and fired up. So, shot to the gut of Shaw on his way in, and a knee lift. So, he's safely in. He's not going to get thrown out the other side. There's a very odd, I'm noticing Shaw's gear, and maybe it's just any wrestling show before 1989. I'm very fascinated in the gear people wear, or if like they're not wearing knee pads. It looks like there's a tear in Mike Shaw's gear, like on the pant leg, and I'm just praying that it doesn't go up too high, because the last thing I need is Mike Shaw in a G-string. I mean, God knows we got enough of that crap with Bastion Booger years later. But Shaw is now tossed to the outside, so Crawford giving him a taste of his own medicine. And then, which he gets back in, he's thrown out onto the announcer's table to the left of the screen, onto the, and basically into Ed Whalen's lap. And now the referee is giving a yellow card to Crawford, which I'm questioning from a kayfabe perspective, because you're going to do something like yellow card, red card. You're kind of thinking of this, treating it like a real sport. So Shaw throws him out three times, doesn't get anything, but Crawford gets a yellow card for doing this. So, I mentioned the gear thing. There are no knee pads being worn in this match, which is kind of surprising considering that guys are getting thrown out of the ring. I mean, that has basically been this entire match. You get a slugfest in the middle, and Shaw is now thrown to the outside on the third side. So I don't know. Is this going to be a battle to see who could throw the other guy out to the fourth side? Who really knows? But I'm kind of wondering where this is all leading. And I thought to myself, geez, try a rest hold, fellas. I mean, you throw a guy to the outside, it's kind of a natural rest hold as the guy gets back into the ring. But, you know, it just seems strange. If Foley is yelling, you can actually hear J.R. Foley, but you can't hear him clearly, so I'm not going to play the audio because I don't know what the hell he said. And then Crawford ends up getting a second yellow card for his trouble, so he's one away from a disqualification as both of them end up outside the ring and are trading punches. And this match ends in a double countout, and I'm like, oh, okay. So literally nothing happened in this match. They just kept chucking the other guy out of the ring like they're in a battle royal, but it just seemed like an odd way to get to a double countout finish until I watched the following week's TV and they had a rematch, Mike Shaw and Dan Crawford, a lumberjack match. So obviously you're going to set up a lumberjack match by having guys getting thrown outside the ring, because that's the whole point of the lumberjack match, to toss somebody to the outside, and then maybe somebody will get in a cheap shot. Maybe you handle the guy a little too roughly, throwing him back in. It can be anything. So after this match, we go back to the ring, and there is a cut between the end of the match and when they show Dan Crawford in the ring, who Apparently, it was $2,000 that he took from J.R. Foley. He kind of took the money and ran in the Steve Miller parlance. So my question is, what the hell's going on here? And who is this pal that's joined him in the ring?
Dan Crawford, you made somebody pretty unhappy tonight.
That would be John Foley.
You took $2,000 away from Mike Shaw, and yeah, John Foley is in shock in the dressing room. How could you do that?
I'm sorry, Ed, and I'd like to extend possibly an invitation to all of you in the audience to send along their good well cards and best wishes to John Foley. But I must tell you, first off, several things. One, Bill Cody tonight,
he offered
his assistance in my match. I didn't ask him. He came up. I appreciate that very much, Bill. Thank you very much.
Bill, it's nice to see you here. I observed while the fight was going on that it was you at ringside.
Yeah, well, I come down once in a while and watch the matches, and I've been watching it for the last two or three weeks, and every time I see Dan Crawford in the ring, somebody seems to be jumping his back. So I figured since I'm here watching his matches, which I enjoy wrestling, I figured I'd ask him if he'd want me in his corner, because I think I owe him something. We've been tag team partners for many years, and he's helped me out many times since I was in trouble.
Okay, first of all, I love it, because he starts the promo by saying, I'm sorry, which is extremely Canadian of him to do, to start by apologizing, and then offering to send a get well card to J.R. Foley, or encouraging people to do so. That's a nice touch as well. Reminded me of the time that there was an event, Bruins event, where I got to meet members of the team, and I got to meet Milan Lucic. Now, he plays now for the Calgary Flames. Somehow his bloated contract made its way there. And this was after he had injured Mike Komisarek of the Canadiens in a fight, and I suggested to him that he should send him a get-well card, because that is the proper manners in that whole thing. So that was actually an American giving that advice to a Canadian. So struck me kind of funny in this case. Now, Bill Cody there to support his once and future tag team partner. He had a career in wrestling dating all the way to 1959. So he's been wrestling so long that the Maple Leafs had won 4 Stanley Cups since he had started wrestling. But he actually finished up in 1987, and he and Crawford would team again in the future for the final couple of years of his career. But yes, the I'm sorry bit, as Crawford, he's not done being very, very Canadian, because he's got to thank a few more people.
I want to take this opportunity to thank some people who contacted me from Victoria, British Columbia with regards to this show. They say they watch it out there and wondered if I'm ever coming that way. I'd sure like to think somewhere in the near future. Particular hello to Dick and Ann Tomlin, 2 kids out there in Victoria who watch it. I got information from Cindy and Paul McKenzie out there in Sanditon. Thank you very much for your regards to how I'm doing here. And I want to say that hopefully I'll be out on the coast one of these days. I look forward to going home as much as I like it here.
It's so polite. It's so Canadian. I mean, there's even a person named McKenzie in the middle of it. It doesn't get any better than that. I'm proud to be an American, certainly, but if for some reason that was taken away from me, or if I had to be born somewhere else, I would want it to be Canada, especially since I would have been taught proper manners coming, you know, growing up as a kid, and having great pride in my country as Canadians seem to. So I have to honor this in some sort of way, and I like to do it through song, and it's a song that I know very well, one that I hear live approximately, 10 or 15 times a year. Oh, Canada, our home and native land, true patriot love in all of us command. With glowing hearts we see thee rise, the true north strong and free. From far and wide, O Canada, we stand on guard for thee. God keep our land glorious and free. O Canada, we stand on guard. Canada, we stand on guard for thee. Oh, it's very stirring tribute, I must say.
At this time, Burger King begins a nationwide search for one man. His name is Herb. We don't know much about Herb, only what his friends tell us.
Herb was unusual.
Herb was different.
What his parents tell us.
Herb was never what you'd call...
normal.
His former teacher.
You had to know how to talk to him. Herbert, pay attention.
Just hearing that Burger King commercial in the Herb campaign, you'd think that they were describing a wrestling fan in some ways, which would make sense because, yes, Herb would serve as the timekeeper at one of the WrestleMania 2 locations. I think it was Nassau or Chicago. It doesn't matter. It's just that when people look back at WrestleMania 2, they're like, who the hell was Herb? And yes, it was from a Burger King commercial, but really, as they're describing him, they are describing a wrestling fan. So he might have just gone to the show anyway instead of being paid to be there as a celebrity. Although, since there were approximately 1.5 million celebrities as part of WrestleMania 2, and we had fewer celebrities back in those days, finding one who wasn't part of WrestleMania 2 was much easier. So we're back to another interview in the ring. And this is a familiar face from the World Wrestling Federation, and actually, not that long before this, Desiree Peterson, or as Ed Whalen calls her, Desiree Peterson. It's very odd pronunciation. I've never heard it said in that manner. But when I think of Desiree Peterson, which is the pronunciation that I'm going to use, I think of one match, June 22nd, 1985, at the Boston Garden against Judy Martin. An incredible beating taken by Desiree, by Judy, who I don't know what got into her that night, but she decided to just kick the crap out of Desiree and throw her primarily onto the announce table with Gorilla Monsoon and Mean Gene Okerlund ringside in the Boston Garden, to the point where it's thought that maybe because Gorilla said some snide things about Judy Martin's weight, and maybe she heard it in the ring, because if you listen to that match, and I think it's on YouTube, I'm pretty sure just the match itself, I think I may have even posted it before, it's pretty crazy, and Desiree actually ends up picking up the victory in that match. Sorry, spoiler alert, but you really should go watch it. But as Ed Whalen is going through her credentials in women's wrestling in 1985 in the United States, for whatever that was, he invents a draw that she had with Wendy Richter, which never took place as far as I could tell. And Desiree, she's pretty face, but who is her rival in this case? Well, it is Rhonda Singh, and that she would later go on to become Bertha Faye in 1995 WWF, a criminally misused character and wrestler at the time period, because she could have been just this character. It's almost like Mike Shaw disease. She could have just been the big woman, like a Bull Nakano, but, you know, a North American version of it, who just comes in and kicks ass, uses her size advantage, but instead making her Bertha Faye and just having her wear the weird outfits and the Harvey Whippleman crap. It's, oh my God, it's so annoying to think about it, especially in 95 WWF, there's not a whole lot to see. She could have been more of a gem given what was there. But I'm interested in what Desiree has to say, if she's as polite as Dan Crawford.
Well, Rhonda doesn't scare me. She doesn't threaten me. I've been with bigger and I've been with worse. But everybody needs stepping stones once in a while, so we'll have her out and we'll see what happens. But I'd like to say a few other words. She happens to be the North American champion. Since I am here in my hometown, Calgary, Alberta, I would like to win that here, and I would be proud if the fans would come out and cheer me on greatly, because I love the fans, I need the fans, and I want them all to come out.
She is nice, and she is very polite, but I don't think she'd exactly set the world on fire. If you drop her in the Wendy Richter spot in 84, yeah, probably would not have worked the same way unless she had a real change in attitude, and very diametrically opposed from Miss Rhonda Singh, who gets the right of reply up next. She's got a big old head of hair that reminds me very much of Matilda the Hun from the original Glow. And Rhonda is going to give us a little bit of a peek behind the curtain.
Well, yes, Ed, there is, actually. It's a very funny connection. I was in Japan, where I am, nor I book out of Japan, and Stu gave me a call, and he says, there's this Desiree Peterson, And she's here, a local Calgary girl. I don't think there's any local Calgary people left in Calgary. But he tells me there's this local girl, and she's out here, and she wants to challenge me for my championship. I have a world championship, 4WA world championship, and she's out to challenge me for this belt. But Ed, can you imagine? You've seen this girl come out here. She's like this little pick here. You can pick them off bit by bit, break her off bit by bit. Now, and you can just crunch her. Like, Ed, this is ridiculous. Like, even suggesting that this girl even step in the ring with me. She's half a tag team championship team. Okay, half of one.
Yeah.
I'm a whole champion. I am not half of nothing. I am whole. I am it. I am the champion. Okay, you know I've been here many times. I've proven myself in rings all over the world. I've just come off a world tour.
Right.
Okay, Stu has especially asked me to come here to do this girl a favor. What favor are we asking to do this girl? This poor girl will probably die in the ring with me. I don't think that's asking a favor of him.
All right.
Look, I'm not going to try to do Stu Hart here, but just picturing him picking up the phone and calling Ronda Singh in Japan, it just strikes me as very, very funny. But it took a while for Ronda to get going. She's kind of stumbling over her words. But eventually, at the end, she's going to die in the ring with me there. Like, oh, okay. So the other person may actually come out of this dead. I guess that's superior healing at the end of the day.
Alan Poash first made his mark in judo as the 1976 heavyweight Olympic bronze medalist. He was only the second American in history to medal in the sport of judo. But to most who know him today, he is pro wrestler Bad News Brown. Alan Poash grew up rough and tough in a section of Harlem where just getting out is a success story.
You grow up in that environment, you have your shares of fights and, you know, going to school and coming back, that's an everyday occurrence. You know, it was up to you to try to learn something to defend yourself to keep from getting beat up every day.
That is taken from a Where Are They Now segment that aired in 1992 during the Summer Olympics on NBC, kind of going back to Alan Coadge's involvement in judo at the 76 Games, winning a bronze medal, the first African-American medal in a sport other than boxing and track and field for the United States. Alan Coadge, Bad News Brown, whatever you want to call him, is a fascinating figure to me. So it goes beyond just me loving his character work. I think part of the reason why he might not be talked about so much is his run in the WWF is only, you know, 2 years and change from 88 to 90. So maybe he doesn't, you know, hit the memory quite the same as the rest of them. It kind of, in fact, fizzles out maybe after 88 with the run with Hogan and Savage, because most of 89, he's just kind of floundering around without much of a feud. But he's such a fascinating individual. He took up judo from an ad that he found on the subway in New York, because he actually did grow up in Harlem, New York. So that's one of those instances of you take something from a person's life and make it part of their character. I know a lot of people made fun, like, boy, he wouldn't seem so tough if they billed him from Calgary, Alberta, Canada, which became his permanent home. And he eventually acquired Canadian citizenship as well. So apparently, if Bad News Brown was still alive, he would want to do a Canadian tribute just as I did earlier. But really, really fascinating guy. He would have been in the 1972 Olympics, but he hurt his knee in the Olympic trials leading up to that, and a lawsuit had to be filed to get him on the team in 76. So it was a long road for him to that medal. And he's in his mid-30s doing judo in the Olympics and finishes third, you know, wins the bronze medal, is on the medal stand, meets President Gerald Ford in a White House ceremony. I saw that on Gary Michael Capetta's Twitter a couple of weeks ago. There's just kind of a fun little picture there because he has hair and he's shaking hands with an American president. I will just never get enough of this guy. And I wish, even though he would be about 75, 76 years old or so, I would love to hear interviews with him now with all the wrestling podcasts that have, you know, proliferated over the last few years. I know this is a long love letter to Bad News Brown, but he is up next and he's taking on Kerry Brown. And I know I should call Bad News Alan because that's what he was known at that time, but 88 to 90 WWF is so burned into my brain. So I'm going to say that the stipulation for this match and feud between Bad News and Kerry Brown is that he gets the right to the name Brown if he defeats Kerry Brown. And Kerry himself, his career was between Calgary and the Kansas City and St. Louis territories from what I could gather. So rather interesting to go between those two places considering I just did Kansas City a couple of weeks ago. And as we start out, there's kind of a rest hold as we get into it because this thing is clipped out for the first 5 minutes. But why do we have to go right to the nerve hold, the boring nerve hold by Kerry Brown? I'm noticing that Bad News is wearing the same black trunks that he would always wear all the way up through Global, which they were showing a lot of Global footage on that NBC thing that they did during the Olympics, because in 1992 he had just come off a run, or he was working in Global at that time as just Bad News. He was not Bad News Allen, or of course Bad News Brown, since the WWF owned that name. So his gear here is the same, but there's some white in his boots. It's not all black. And I thought to myself, did he have those when he went to the WWF? And yes, if you look at his early 88 matches, I went back and checked his debut, he is wearing those boots. But when you go to the end of 88, when, you know, I watch a match on Superstars from December, the boots are now all black. J.R. Foley kind of stops by commentary and yells, but it's completely incoherent. I mean, it's almost General Adnan levels, except that it's not funny at all. Like, if he had just done fa-la-la-la-la-la, you know, that would have been a lot better. As the crowd starts chanting Bad News, as, yes, that nerve hold still continues along. I mean, if you're going to clip matches, could you clip the damn nerve hold out of it? At the very least, though, they are facing away from the hard camera, which I endorse in this case because it's a freaking nerve hold and it's just taking forever. A corner whip and Bad News goes in hard, and kind of forget that Bad News could sell. I mean, his selling in the WWF, granted, it would be a lot of, you know, him on top dominating, and then you get the babyface comeback, and then, you know, he gets pinned or DQ'd or whatever. But he could sell for a guy who was really in professional wrestling only for the money, because judo did, you know, not a lot of money in judo, quite frankly, at least back in those days. I mean, maybe from an MMA perspective, who knows? I don't know much about that, but it's interesting to think about Bad News' career through the years and just kind of the moves that he would do in the ring. He's kind of a straight-up brawler. You never really saw him do much in the way of judo moves. I don't think, anyway. But then again, I'm not really an expert on that. I'm more Sudoku than judoka, I think. So, anyway, a back rake by Bad News Brown, channeling General Adnan again. But then we end up back in the shitty nerve hold that is being billed as a claw. I don't care what it is. I'm just a little bit tired of watching it because we saw it for the first 90 seconds of this thing as they cut to it. As he gets tossed to the outside, Bad News does. And I notice at ringside, there's no blue mats or anything like you'd see later in the WWF. But it's a green carpet in the similar fashion of like a mini golf course. That would be funny if they set something like that up at ringside. Like, oh, there's a windmill. Maybe this is the promotion built for a hole-in-one Darceau, but, you know, some 13 years ahead of time. I'm just realizing in kind of reading my notes on this match, why did I have to use the word Brown for Kerry Brown? Because now I'm getting him confused with Bad News Brown, because it was Kerry Brown who did the back rake. And that's when he went back to the crappy nerve hold. So, but as I said, tossed to the outside, and Kerry Brown puts his head down and gets a boot to the face from Bad News. So it's not really much of a judo move, but it is what it is. But Kerry somehow maintains control of things, and he goes up to the top rope, and he is slammed off there by Bad News, who then hits the running leg drop, which gets a two count. One thing, Bad News, certainly a slimmer man at this point in time, and just thinking of where he was, he is over 40 years old at this point. I mean, as I said, he's in the Olympics in his mid-30s, so, you know, kind of a late bloomer, I guess, as Kerry Brown sort of begs off, and we get a quick knee drop to the throat. That gets two for Bad News, and a vertical suplex by bad news, which I don't recall him ever doing that when he's in the WWF. He almost forgot to like fall down with it because Kerry just kind of drops off the top, like kind of like a crane collapsing. I can't think of a great way to put it. Corner whip is reversed by Kerry Brown, a clothesline out of the corner by Bad News Allen, who then goes up to the top rope. Again, very interesting to see Bad News doing that, but J.R. Foley reaches up there and pushes him off, and that is enough to score a red card for the disqualification. So according to the stipulation that I invented, Bad News now wins the right to use the name Brown at some point in the future. Maybe not right away, but a couple of years from now if he needs to change his name before he goes to the big promotion. But he doesn't want to accept the victory quite like that. The referee goes to raise his hand, and just as he did in the WWF, he kind of pulls his arm away. He's not going to have his hand raised by anybody else.
Foley grabbed him. Now, what was he calling here?
That was a red card.
A red card against Foley. A red card. So Foley and Roberts. Foley and Kerry Brown are disqualified from the whole thing.
Kerry Brown is disqualified. That was a bad interference. 9:55.
Certainly not the way that Bad News wanted to pick up the victory over Kerry Brown, but I do have some good news. After the bout, he's going to stick around in the ring for a little bit of a promo, and in this case, Bruce Hart, is not around to kind of throw him off or anything.
Let me tell you people out there, I would expect something from the Cabbage Patch Kid and that derelict manager of his, but I guarantee you one thing. You ain't heard the last of me yet, Kerry Brown. I met you here man to man, one on one. You tried to break every rule in the book, but we're not finished yet. This is only the beginning.
All right, that's more like it. That's the Bad News Allen, Bad News Brown that I grew up with, okay? The one that I became accustomed to. Although, please note that he steered clear of the phrase beer belly sharecroppers because, number one, he's a babyface, so it doesn't make sense in that perspective. And number two, I don't know how many sharecroppers there are in Alberta. Just kind of looking it up, there doesn't seem to be much about it. I mean, I know that there is farming out there, but, you know, the season's a little bit shorter. It gets cold, so who knows? So as a reply to Bad News' remark, we get his opponent, Kerry Brown, and manager J.R. Foley in the ring. And I have not yet mentioned J.R. Foley's facial hair, which a bizarre choice for the year 1985. It is in the style of Adolf Hitler / Charlie Chaplin. I don't know why you would go with that, say, oh, I don't know, after 1933. Feels like a pretty bad choice, but hey, you know, when you grow your facial hair, you know, sometimes you think it looks better one way. I mean, when I grew mine out, I was horrified that there was a little bit of gray in it. But then I came to realize that it actually adds a little bit of gravitas to my face. It frames my face properly. So I'm probably going to hang on to it for a little bit, even though this was just going to be an unemployment beard. I don't know what I'm supposed to do now. Do I have to update my social media and, like, you know, to reflect my facial hair? Like, how does this work? Like, I'm not familiar with how this is supposed to go. Anyway, too much of a divergence here, but let's see what Kerry and his manager have to say.
No comment at all, Mr. Whalen.
No comment.
Listen, Closer was the toughest I've been wearing. I've been hit by a lot of strong and tough men. And he would rank in the top 10, let me tell you that. He almost rattled my jaw, took it off my head. But I'll tell you what, I got the army behind me, J.R. Foley and his illustrious followers. Now let's just find out how tough you are against two or three. I underestimated your power, man, but I'm not going to let it happen again. When I get my chance again, you better watch your back. You better turn around every corner, every pillar and post, because I'll be there looking for the chance and the time when I can get you and get you at a disadvantage, Alan, and I'll finish you just like you tried to do me.
It's not bad. I'm glad that they actually let Kerry talk in this case so I could hear what his voice sounds like, because he didn't get to talk in the group promo earlier with Ron Starr and Honky Tonk Wade. But glad he stayed away from any genocidal references with the guy standing next to him's facial hair and what that looks like. I mean, that would not have been a good look. But just kind of your basic heel promo a la Dr. Claw at the end of every Inspector Gadget episode. You know, I'll get you next time, Gadget. next time.
I said shake, round and roll. Shake, round and roll. Shake, round and roll. Shake, round and roll. Well, you won't do right to save your doggone soul.
Big Joe Turner, the singer of Shake, Rattle, and Roll that you heard just there, passed away a couple days after the show aired in 1985 at the age of 74. He was the first singer to bring that song to the masses, and later done by Bill Haley and his Comets and Elvis Presley, which is probably my favorite version of the song of Shake, Rattle, and Roll. But I do have a fondness for the Big Joe Turner version. But another version of the Shake, Rattle, and Roll by somebody in our feature bout here is Honky Tonk Wayne, and that would be the name of his finisher in the World Wrestling Federation a few years after this, teaming up with Ron Starr as the tag team champions. They are taking on Leo Burke and Hubert Gallant, which, very Canadian name on that guy. And in fact, if you look at his record all through the 80s as a pro wrestler, it's just kind of wrestling across Canada in the various territories. Leo Burke, when I think of him, I think of Bret Hart's book and how he has a finish named after him, the Leo Burke finish, quote unquote, which you don't really have to, the best way to explain what that is it's the finish from SummerSlam 92 against the British Bulldog, where you go for the sunset flip and then you hook the guy's legs who is trying to execute the sunset flip and you end up getting the pin that way. Ron Starr, the tag team partner of the Honky Tonk Man, has a book called Bad to the Bone, 25 Years of Riots and Wrestling. I was looking to see if I could actually get a copy of that on Kindle or anywhere else, even a hard copy of it, but that seems like a bridge too far. It may well be out of print. I just can't find it anywhere for whatever reason. Just be a very interesting guy to hear stories from, given how many different territories that he worked in over the years. Now, the shocking thing about this bout is it's an entire match that does not appear to be clipped. At least we get to see the beginning of it, at the very least, as we learn right as this match gets underway that Jim Davies, serving as color man for Ed Whalen this week, well, he's not going to be around next week because he's taking some vacay.
We look forward next week to seeing Desiree Peterson in this ring against Rhonda Singh. Pretty little girl, that Desiree.
She certainly is. I'll hate to miss that. I'll be suffering on the beach in Hawaii, Ed.
You devil. I'm sure you'll be suffering.
Now, I watched that next week's show, and I'm not sure exactly what Jim Davies is bringing to the table other than being just a secondary voice for Ed Whalen to play off of. I mean, Ed can be a little corny at times, but I think he's a little bit better than what Jim is bringing on the weekly broadcast. So as we get going into this, Burke is just working an armbar spot on Ron Starr, and then all of a sudden, we get the matches clipped after 2 minutes, after we see a little bit of the armbar. Like, why are you clipping it exactly at that point? Like, these decisions. I mean, I need to watch a director's cut of Stampede Wrestling. I need to know what Ed Whalen's thinking is behind all the various decisions that he's making, because I'm just scratching my head, because now all of a sudden the match shifts, and now Hubert Gallant is in there, and he's the one who's in peril, and they just say, oh, he hit his head on the outside of the ring. Okay, but we don't get to see it, but then they tell us, okay, he's bleeding above the eye. So maybe you didn't want to show him getting cut. Maybe you didn't want to, maybe he was running the razor too openly, like he was that guy in the boxer-wrestler match with Muhammad Ali, Buddy Wolf, who was just openly blading on TV as Howard Cosell is like, why am I doing this? Why am I doing play-by-play for this? But yes, indeed, Gallant is bleeding above the eye, and it's a cut, and it's being worked over by Honky Tonk and Ron Starr. And now all of a sudden, Bad News appears to make the save, and he's getting overwhelmed by Honky Tonk and Starr in a two-on-one situation as Kerry Brown now comes in. There's a lot of bodies kind of flying around in there, and the heels all end up running into each other in the middle of the ring. They do that sort of Irish whip spot where all of them end up running into each other. And it's my man Bad News who ends up clearing the ring of everybody. And this must be where the Honky Tonk Man, Honky Tonk Wayne, gained respect for Bad News, because I can't think of any other reason why. Because Bad News, when he gets to WWF, and maybe I'll go more into this in the future, how in the Survivor Series, when Bad News was there, he had that character trait of he would walk out on his team because he was such a loner and set so far apart from all the other heels. But did you notice in 88, 89, and even in 90, when Bad News left beforehand, but he was supposed to be on his team, he was going to be on the same team as the Honky Tonk Man every single year. So there must have been respect, and I'm going to actually draw the line right here that Honky gained respect for Bad News, and they end up teammates, or they would have been, three separate times. So yeah, that is our feature match that gets clipped almost immediately and then ends on what appears to be a DQ, and we're just going to have to continue this another time. But we do get a little bonus on this video, as it timed out at about 44 minutes, so it looked like a normal show with the commercials cut out. However, we actually have one set of commercials, which is pretty nice.
You can choose frozen beef, or you can choose fresh ground beef. Choose fresh. Choose Wendy's. You can choose rehydrated onions among the toppings, or you can choose fresh onions and other fresh toppings. Choose fresh. Choose Wendy's. You can choose a hamburger kept warm under heat lamps, or you can choose a hamburger served fresh, hot off the grill. Choose fresh. Choose Wendy's.
I've always been very fond of Wendy's, but the thing is, in the mid-80s, all the way up to the mid to late 90s, didn't really have them in the area in which I lived in Massachusetts. When I'm in high school, the nearest Wendy's was about 15 miles up the highway. And I remember going there with my friends at one point, but the funny thing was, it was during Lent, and it was a Friday, so I got my burgers, and they're like, oh, yeah, you can't eat that if you're abiding by it. And for some reason, I was abiding by the no meat on Fridays for Lent, which I pretty much did up until around 2016, when I said, you know what, this isn't going to work for me anymore. So I took the burgers, and I actually brought them home and ate them at 12:01, because that's me. It was weird, and that's how I do things. An ad for Labatt Blue, which, I don't know, the jingle, pretty good.
There's heart in this land, it's there in all we do, that's where I am.
I enjoyed that, but it kind of sounded like a Trey Parker-style South Park parody of a song, just thinking back to Team America World Police from 2004, that song, Pearl Harbor sucked, and I miss you, do-do-do-do-do, you know, in the style of one of those things. And not to derail this whole program on Stampede Wrestling just based on this one block of commercials, but oh my god, it's a commercial for cat food.
Presenting the Meowtones. All over Canada, cats are singing the praises of Meow Mix brand cat food, because only Meow Mix has the three flavors cats love best: tuna, liver, and chicken, and tastes so good cats ask for it by name.
Meow, meow, meow.
In perfect harmony.
Meow.
Decided to throw in my own cat's meow there at the end, although she doesn't eat Meow Mix anymore. She's on Friskies, but I hope that those cats in the Meow Mix commercial were all Canadian-born, because are they actually subject to CanCon regulations for animals in commercials? I don't know. Maybe that's something for another day. But we do get a nice little bonus here at the end, as Bad News, once again, going to get another promo, but he's dressed up in civilian clothes, and he looks like he's ready to hit the clubs, because he's got a nice little pinky ring, and we got a familiar-sounding match that's coming up.
You know, I was standing back there watching this match, and it brought back some back flashes of some of the stuff I did. But I was sort of, my blood was starting to boil, to see these two men up here, what they did to that Hubert Glant, and then what they did to Leo out here. But, I mean, Hubert, the man is really injured. Okay, this is a sport, you know? But these guys come out here, they want to hurt, they want to injure, they want to maim. But I tell you one thing, if they got any guts, especially with that Carrie Brown, the Cabbage Patch Kid, if they got any guts to come out here next week, the three of them, Jerry Morrow, I think Leo, he'll be feeling a little better, but Hubert, he'll be out for a while. And myself, we'll take these three idiots, and we're going to teach them a lesson once and for all. If they want to break rules, we'll break rules. If they want to wrestle fair and square, we'll wrestle fair and square. But I guarantee you one thing, it won't be on 3-on-1. And to put a little spice to the game here, we're going to have an elimination match. Whoever gets pinned here, they're going to have to get pinned in the middle. They're going to have to leave the ring. So that may be 3-on-1, it may be 2 against 2, it may be 3 against 3. But somebody's going to leave here. And I guarantee you one thing, our team is going to be in the middle here, and we're going to pin these guys, we're going to ship them off once and for all, and we're going to get some justice in this ring.
Maybe it wasn't Bruce Hart's fault earlier that Bad News was stumbling over his words, because Jerry Morrow was there. He helped Bad News clean out the ring. I probably should have mentioned him, but it doesn't matter, because Bad News is my hero. But maybe it's just him having somebody standing next to him is kind of throwing him off. Maybe that's why he became such a loner later on, just kind of getting some insight into his character. But yes, Bad News, 100% capable of performing in a Survivor Series style match, because that is what he's proposing. So now we got to get a retort from the other side, with Honky Tonk Wayne and Ron Starr.
You want to talk about it,
the winners prevail. We're still the champions. That's all that matters. We got the belts. We got everything we want in this world. If they want a six-man elimination, that's fine with the Memphis Mafia. That's fine with the Honky Tonk Man and Ron Starr, because we like six. We had six eggs over easy this morning for breakfast.
Wrong! You all had Special K with banana.
I got six old ladies. I got six Cadillacs, and I got six diamond rings right here, Ed. So let me tell you all about six. They want eliminations, they can have it. We'll eliminate them one by one, and there'll be three of us standing in the ring, myself, Ron Starr, and Carrie Brown.
Kind of like the Holocaust, you know, 666. You get my meaning, Ed?
Well, I could have done without the Holocaust reference, but at least J.R. Foley isn't there with his mustache to kind of add even more awkwardness to the situation. But to close things out, Ed Whalen, I don't know if this was a regular thing where he'd say this, but it kind of sounds that way.
In the meantime, and in between time, that's it. Another edition of Stampede Wrestling. Bye-bye now.
Tonight, following SCTV, the master of late night welcomes celebrity filmmakers like Bette Midler, Andrea Martin, and Catherine O'Hara. It's the David Letterman Holiday Film Festival. It's a special.
And yes, it cuts off at that point. Letterman in 1985 calling himself the master of late night. It might be a bridge too far, considering that Carson was still around and most certainly still had his fastball at that point. I don't know. I've already spoken chapter and verse on Leno and Letterman, because you know I'm on Team Leno, partly because he's from Massachusetts, but also partly because I found him funnier. It's the fact is, Letterman wasn't even trying in the 90s once he didn't get the Tonight Show, but people always are like, oh, Leno dumbed down his comedy. It's like, yeah, and Letterman wasn't even trying and was getting his ass kicked not only by Leno but by Nightline. But you know what? I'm not doing a review of late night television from the 80s. So that's it for Stampede Wrestling for November 22nd, 1985. Elsewhere in podcasts, of course, my side project with the sportscaster Steve Bennett, the Adams Division podcast. We released the part two of our favorite single-season sports teams, although in my case, I kind of cheated on one because it was an Olympic team. Do tune in to find out which one, because there is more than one in theory that you could choose as a all-time favorite. Given how old I am, you might be able to extrapolate and figure it out. That is on the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, so You can find that show there. Now, on the Our Vantage Point podcast with Joe Morata and Michael Quinn, they take a look at a promotion that I have not gotten to yet, Southwestern Championship Wrestling, or Southwest Championship Wrestling, to be precise, from January of 1983, when they were on the USA Network. They predated the WWF. I'm not sure when I'm going to get to Southwest, although I have seen, I was alerted to some Texas All-Star from the mid-80s with a very young Shawn Michaels that might be of great interest in covering in the future. Oh, as I mentioned, the sportscasters, upcoming guests there, Brian Curtis, Albert Chen, John Wertheim. I mean, the Rolodex for Steve Bennett is just unbelievable. And I'm just honored to be somewhere in that. I guess I would be after Wertheim. There's probably somebody between me and Wertheim in the Rolodex. Actually, no, who has a Rolodex at this point? It's all in a cell phone. Anyway, or the Wrestling Podcast About Nothing with Mike Crockett and allegedly Brawler Malonis, because he hasn't been there the last couple of weeks because he's out working towns for Ring of Honor. So permanent guest host Brian Fury, the owner of Chaotic Wrestling, has been there. And this week, Tarzan Taylor returns and they look at King of the Ring 1995. So if you're a big fan of Savio Vega, or even Quang for that matter, you might want to tune in to that one. I'm not sure when Malonis is going to be back on that show full time. It's kind of like, and not to bring Valerie Harper into this again, the early seasons of Valerie or Valerie's Family, where the dad's the pilot and he's not there. That's what Brian Malonis is right now. So I do encourage you to check all of that out. I'm going to do another express Vinny Vegas corner without the music because I went 3-0 last week without it. If I do poorly, I'll certainly bring back the music. But 3-0 on my picks. It was 2-0 going to the Houston-New Orleans game, which was absolutely crazy. And just to go quickly through it, the New York Giants getting 2 points at home against the Buffalo Bills. I do not trust the Bills as a road favorite, considering the fact that they cannot pass the ball. Giants had some issues containing Dak Prescott in that Cowboys game, but I don't think they're going to have the same problem against Buffalo. I don't think the Bills could throw on them quite as effectively as Dallas did. And Saquon Barkley, I think, going to have a big game. So I like the Giants +2 in that one. Thursday night game, so actually tonight as this show drops, Carolina is hosting the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, who two pick sixes for Jameis Winston on Sunday against the San Francisco 49ers. I mean, how long is that guy going to be starting? I love Carolina in this game, giving 6.5 points. I don't know if Christian McCaffrey is going to score 2 touchdowns again, but I remember having a conversation off air with Scott Cruscolo when we were waiting to do the Place to Be podcast, and he asked me who he should take number one in his fantasy draft with Ezekiel Elliott's contract status still up in the air at that point. I should have suggested Christian McCaffrey, just basically because Carolina just feeds him the ball constantly. And my last pick, Kansas City at the Oakland Raiders. Oakland, I think, you know, put up a good performance against Denver, as they will show them after the whole Antonio Brown thing had gone down just days before. But Kansas City only giving 8.5 points against the Raiders. I feel like I'm getting a discount there. I would have looked at Kansas City even if they were giving 11. So I feel like there's an underlay there, or an overlay, depending, I guess, how you look at it. So Kansas City -8.5 at the Oakland Raiders. Now, I took a little poll for next week's show. Originally, I was going to do the July 11th, 1994 Raw with the Bret Hart versus 1-2-3 Kid match, but I am going to detour to the World Wrestling Federation in the year 1988, because apparently it's been over a year since I've done a show from that year in the WWF. So it's the year I started watching. You know, it's very near and dear to my heart. Plus, it's got Bad News Brown in a big angle on the Brother Love show, assaulting Jack Tunney and having some very controversial things to say. And you're going to see Mr. Perfect Kurt Hennig being referred to by his full name, the Powers of Pain and their recent now alliance with Mr. Fuji from the Survivor Series 88. Oh, yeah, the Survivor Series 88 once again comes into my life. All roads in my wrestling fandom lead to that. So do tune in next week for that show. Now, I thank you so much for listening, but if you could be a dear, please subscribe on iTunes, Apple Podcasts. That is always a big help to this show. And leave a review on Apple Podcasts. 5 stars is definitely appreciated. You know why? Because it provides what is known as social proof that you are listening to and enjoying this podcast. And do the same for the Pro Wrestling Only feed as well while you're there. You could just do a copy paste, and well, I guess you might have to edit it because you'd want to, you know, reference. You wouldn't want to reference my show specifically. You'd want to reference the other great shows on the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Now, I am out of here for this week because I got to wait for that phone to ring, and it might ring soon. Who knows? Of course, I probably have it on silent because I'm doing the podcast, so I should figure out where my phone is. Turn the damn thing on. Hope it rings. But again, thank you for listening, and do tune in next Thursday for another exciting episode of Greetings from Allentown.
Back then, the only two names they knew in Uganda were Idi Amin and Ed Whalen.